the cider house. And even if the cider house had been lit, or if there had been the clearest daylight imaginable, the house was too far away. Only the brightest carnival lights, especially the distinctive lights of the Ferris wheel, were visible from the cider house roof. The visibility didn't exist the other way around.
"I want to be a pilot," Wally said. "I want to fly, I really do. If I had my pilot's license and my own plane, I could do all the spraying at the orchards. I'd get a crop duster, but I'd paint it like a fighter. It's so clumsy driving those dumb sprayers around behind those dumb tractors, up and down those dumb hills." It was what Candy's father, Ray, was doing at the moment. Meanie Hyde was sick, and Everett Taft, the foreman, had asked Ray if he'd mind driving a night spray. Ray knew the equipment so well. It was the last spray before harvest, and somewhere in the blackened inland greenery that lay below the Ferris wheel, Raymond Kendall and Vernon Lynch were spraying their way through Ocean View. Sometimes Wally sprayed. Homer was learning how. And sometimes Herb Fowler sprayed, but Herb protested against night spraying.
"I have better things to do at night," he'd say.
It was better to spray at night because the wind dropped in the evenings, especially along the coast. Wally wasn't spraying tonight because it was his last night home. He was going back to college in the morning.
"You'll look after Candy for me, won't you, Homer?" Wally asked, as they loomed above the rocky coast and Kate Kenneth's crowded beach.
The scarce bonfires from the summer's end beach parties winked. The wheel descended. Candy would finish her senior year at the Girls' Academy in Camden. She'd get home most weekends, but Wally would stay in Orono except for Thanksgiving and Christmas and the longer vacations.
"Right," said Homer Wells.
"If I were flying in the war," Wally said, "if I joined, and if I flew, I mean, if I were in a bomber, I'd rather be in the B-24 than the B-25. I'd rather be strategic than tactical, bomb things, not people. And I wouldn't want to fly a fighter in the war. That's shooting people, too." Homer Wells didn't know what Wally was talking about. Homer didn't follow the war. He didn't know the news. A B-24 was a four-engine heavy bomber that was used for strategic bombing, bridges, oil refineries, fuel depots, railroad tracks. It hit industry. It didn't drop its bombs on armies. That was the work of the B-25, a medium tactical bomber. Wally had studied the war with more interest than he pursued his botany, or his other courses, at the University of Maine. But the war, which was called, in Maine in those days, the war in Europe, was very far from Homer's mind. People with families are the people who worry about wars.
"Do Bedouins have wars?" wondered Homer Wells. "If they do they much care?"
He was eager for the harvest to start. He was curious about meeting the migrants, about seeing the Negroes. He didn't know why. Were they like orphans? Did they not quite belong? Were they not quite of sufficient use? Because he loved Wally, he resolved to keep his mind off Candy. It was the kind of bold resolve that his sense of elevation on the Ferris wheel enhanced. And this evening there was a plan. Homer Wells, an orphan attached to routine, liked for every evening to have a plan, even if he was not that excited about this one. He drove Wally in Senior's Cadillac to Kendall's Lobster Pound, where Candy was waiting. He left Candy and Wally there. Ray would be out spraying for several hours, and Candy and Wally wanted a private goodbye together before Ray came home. Homer would go pick up Deborah Pettigrew and take her to the drive-in in Cape Kenneth. It would be their first drive-in without Candy and Wally, and Homer wondered if the touch-this-but-not-that rules would vary when he and Deborah were alone. As he navigated an exact path through the Pettigrew's violent dogs, he was disappointed in himself that he wasn't dying to find out whether Deborah would or wouldn't. A particularly athletic dog snapped very loudly near his face, but the chain around the dog's neck appeared to strangle the beast in midair. It landed solidly on its ribcage, with a sharp groan, and was slow getting to its feet.
"Why do people want to keep dogs?" Homer wondered.
It was a Western movie, from which Homer could only conclude that crossing the country in a wagon train was an exercise in lunacy and sorrow. At the very least, he thought, one should make some arrangements with the Indians before starting out. The film was void of arrangements. and Homer was unable to arrange for the use of Herb Fowler's rubbers, which he kept in his pocket, in case. Deborah Pettigrew was substantially freer than she had ever been before, but her ultimate restraint was no less firm. "No!" she yelled once. "There's no need to shout," said Homer Wells, removing his hand from the forbidden place. "Well, that's the second time you did that particular thing," Deborah pointed out, a mathematical certainty and other certainties apparent in her voice. In Maine, in 1940-something, Homer Wells was forced to accept that what they called necking was permitted, what they called making out was within the rules, but that what he had done with Melanie, what Grace Lynch appeared to be offering him, and what Candy and Wally did, or had done at least once, to all of that the answer was no. But how did Candy ever get pregnant? Homer Wells wondered, with Deborah Pettigrew's damp little face pressed to his chest. Her hair tickled his nose, but he could just manage to see over her. He could witness the Indian massacre. With Herb Fowler dispensing prophylactics even faster than Dr. Larch passed them out to the women at St. Cloud's, how could Wally have let her get pregnant? Wally was so provided for. Homer Wells couldn't understand why Wally was even interested in war. But would an orphan ever worry that he was spoiled or untested? Is an orphan ever bored or restless? Or are those luxurious states of mind? He remembered that Curly Day had been bored. "Are you asleep, Homer?" Deborah Pettigrew asked him. "No," he said, "I was just thinking." "Thinking what?" Deborah asked. "How come Wally and Candy do it and we don't?" Homer asked her. Deborah Pettigrew appeared to be wary of the question, or at least she was surprised by its bluntness. She was cautious in composing an answer. "Well," she began philosophically, "they're in love, Wally and Candy, aren't they?"
"Right," said Homer Wells.
"Well, you never said you were in love with me," Deborah added. "And I never said I was with you." "That's right," Homer said. "So it's against the rules to do it if you aren't in love." "Look at it this way," said Deborah Pettigrew. She bit her lower lip. It was absolutely as hard as she had ever thought. "If you're in love and there's an accident, if somebody gets pregnant is what I mean, then if you're in love, you get married. Wally and Candy are in love, and if they have an accident, they'll get married."
"Maybe," thought Homer Wells, "maybe the next time." But what he said was,
"I see."
What he thought was, "So those are the rules. It's about accidents. It's about getting pregnant and not wanting to have a baby. My God, is everything about that?"
He considered taking the rubber out of his pocket and presenting it to Deborah Pettigrew. If the argument was that an accidental pregnancy was really the only reason for not doing it, what did she think of the alternative that Herb Fowler so repeatedly presented? But by arguing in this fashion, wouldn't he be suggesting that all intimacy could be crudely accounted for? Or was crude itself? Or was intimacy crude only for him? In the movie, several human scalps were dangling from a spear. For reasons unfathomable to Homer Wells, the Indians carried on and on about the spear as if such a spear were a treasure. Suddenly, a cavalry officer had his hand pinned to a tree by an arrow. The man went to great lengths, using his teeth and his other hand, to free the arrow from the tree, but the arrow still stuck very prominently through his hand. An Indian with a tomahawk approached the cavalry officer. It looked like the end of him, especially since he insisted on trying to cock his pistol with the thumb of the hand that had the arrow stuck through it. "Why doesn't he use his good hand?" Homer Wells wondered. But the thumb worked. The pistol finally was cocked. Homer Wells concluded from this demonstration that the arrow had managed to pass through the hand without damaging the branch of the median nerve that goes to the muscles of the thumb. Lucky man, thought Homer Wells, as the cavalry officer shot the approaching Indian in the heart. It must be the heart, thought Homer Wells, because the Indian died instantly. It was funny how he could see the pictures of the hand in Gray's Anatomy more clearly than he could see the movie. He took Deborah home, begging her forgiveness for not offering to walk her to her door. One of the dogs was loose, it had broken its chain, and it pawed furiously at the driver's side window, which Homer had rolled up just in time. It breathed and slobbered and clicked its teeth against the glass, which became so fogged and smeared that Homer had difficulty seeing when he turned the Cadillac around.
"Cut it out, Eddie!" Deborah Pettigrew was screaming at the dog as Homer drove away. "Would you just cut it out, Eddie, please?"
But the dog chased the Cadillac for nearly a mile. "Eddie," thought Homer Wells. "Didn't Nurse Angela name someone Eddie once?" He thought so, but it must have been someone who was adopted quickly, the way it was supposed to be done. By the time he got to Kendall's Lobster Pound, Ray was home. He was making tea and warming his deeply lined, cracked hands on the pot. Under his ragged nails was the mechanic's permanent oil-black grime.
"Well, look who survived the drive-in," Ray said.
"You better sit a while and have some tea with me."
Homer could see that Candy and Wally were out on the dock, huddled together.
"Lovebirds don't feel the cold, I guess," Ray said to Homer. "It don't look like they're finished saying goodbye."
Homer was happy to have the tea and to sit with Ray. He liked Ray, and he knew Ray liked him.
"What'd you learn today?" Ray asked him.
Homer was going to say something about the drive-in rules, but he guessed that wasn't what Ray meant.
"Nothing," said Homer Wells.
"No, I'll bet you learned something," Ray said. "You're a learner. I know because I was one. Once you see how something is done, you know how to do it yourself. That's all I mean."
Ray had taught Homer oil changes and lubrications, plugs and points and engine timing, fuel line maintenance and front-end alignment. He'd shown the boy how to tighten a clutch, and, to Ray's astonishment, Homer had remembered. He'd also shown him a valve job and how to replace the universal. In one summer, Homer Wells had learned more about mechanics than Wally knew. But it wasn't just Homer's manual dexterity that Ray was fond of. Ray respected loneliness, and an orphan, he imagined, had a fair share of that.
"Shoot," Ray said. "I bet there's nothing you couldn't learn. Nothing your hands wouldn't remember if your hands ever got to hold it, whatever it was."
"Right," said Homer Wells, smiling. He remembered the perfect balance in the set of dilators with the Douglas points, how you could hold one steadily between your thumb and index finger just by resting the shaft against the pad of your middle finger. It would move only and exactly when and where you moved it. And how wonderfully precise it was, Homer thought, that the vaginal speculum comes in more than one size, that there was always a size that was just right, and how sensitive an adjustment could be accomplished by just a half turn of the little thumb screw, how the duck-billed speculum could hold the lips of the vagina open exactly wide enough. Homer Wells, 21, breathing in the steam from the hot tea, sat waiting for his life to begin. In the Cadillac with Wally, driving back to Ocean View, the rock-and-water prettiness of Hart's Haven giving way to the scruffier, more tangled land of Hart's Rock, Homer said,
"I was wondering, but don't tell me if you'd rather not talk about it, I was just wondering how it happened that Candy got pregnant. I mean, weren't you using anything?"
"Sure I was," Wally said. "I was using one of Herb Fowler's rubbers, but it had a hole in it."
"It had a hole in it?" said Homer Wells.
"Not a big one," Wally said, "but I could tell it had a hole. You know, it leaked."
"Any hole is big enough," Homer said.
"Sure is," Wally said. "The way he carries the things around with him, it probably got poked by something in his pocket."
"I guess you don't use the rubbers Herb throws at you anymore," said Homer Wells.
"That's right," Wally said. When Wally was asleep, as peacefully as a prince, as out to the world as a king, Homer Wells slipped out of bed, found his pants, found the rubbers in the pocket, and took one to the bathroom where he filled it up with water from the cold water tap. The hole was tiny but precise. A fine but uninterrupted needle of water streamed out of the end of the rubber. The hole was bigger than a pinprick, but not nearly so large as a nail would make. Maybe Herb Fowler used a thumbtack or the point of a compass, thought Homer Wells. It was a deliberate sort of hole, perfectly placed, dead center. The thought of Herb Fowler making holes made Homer Wells shiver. He remembered the first fetus he'd seen on his way back from the incinerator, how it appeared to have fallen from the sky. He recalled the extended arms of the murdered fetus from Three Mile Falls.
and the bruise that was green going to yellow on Grace Lynch's breast. Had Grace's journey to St. Cloud's originated with one of Herb Fowler's prophylactics? In St. Cloud's, he had seen anguish and the plainer forms of unhappiness, and depression and destructiveness. He was familiar with mean-spiritedness and with injustice, too. But this is evil, isn't it? Wondered Homer Wells. Have I seen evil before? He thought of the woman with the pony's penis in her mouth. What do you do when you recognize evil? He wondered. He looked out Wally's window, but in the darkness, in his mind's eye, he saw the eroded, still unplanted hillside behind the hospital and the boys' division at St. Cloud's. He saw the thick but damaged, sound-absorbing forest beyond the river that carried away his grief for Fuzzy Stone. If he had known Mrs. Grogan's prayer, he would have tried it, but the prayer that Homer used to calm himself was the end of Chapter 43 of David Copperfield. There being 20 more chapters to go, these words were perhaps too uncertain for a prayer, and Homer spoke them to himself uncertainly. Not as if he believed the words were true, but as if he were trying to force them to be true. By repeating and repeating the words, he might make the words true for him, for Homer Wells. I have stood aside to see the phantoms of those days go by me. They are gone, and I resume the journey of my story. But all that night he lay awake, because the phantoms of those days were not gone. Like the tiny, terrible holes in the prophylactics, the phantoms of those days were not easy to detect, and their meaning was unknown. But they were there. In the morning, Wally left, half-heartedly, for the university in Orono. The next day, Candy left for Camden Academy. The day before the picking crew arrived at Ocean View, Homer Wells, the tallest and oldest boy at Cape Kenneth High School, attended the first class meeting of senior biology. His friend Deborah Pettigrew had to lead him to the laboratory. Homer got lost en route and wandered into a class called Woodshop. The textbook for senior biology was B.A. Bensley's Practical Anatomy of the Rabbit. The text and illustrations were intimidating to the other students, but the book filled Homer Wells with longing. It was a shock for him to realize how much he missed Dr. Larch's well-worn copy of Gray's. Homer at first glance was critical of Bensley. Whereas Gray's began with the skeleton, Bensley began with the tissues. But the teacher of the class was no fool. A cadaverous man was Mr. Hood, but he pleased Homer Wells by announcing that he did not intend to follow the text exactly. The class, like Gray's, would begin with the bones. Comforted by what for him was routine, Homer relished his first look at the ancient yellowed skeleton of a rabbit. The class was hushed. Some students were repulsed. Wait till they get to the urogenital system, thought Homer Wells, his eyes skimming over the perfect bones. But this thought shocked him, too. He realized he was looking forward to getting to the poor rabbit's urogenital system. He had a lateral view of the rabbit's skull. He tested himself with the naming of parts. It was so easy for him. Cranial, orbital, nasal, frontal, mandible, maxilla, premaxilla. How well he remembered Clara and the others who had taught him so much. As for Clara, she was finally put to rest in a place she might not have chosen for herself. The cemetery in St. Cloud's was in the abandoned part of town. Perhaps this was appropriate, thought Dr. Larch, who supervised Clara's burial, because Clara herself had been abandoned, and surely she had been more explored and examined than she had ever been loved. Nurse Edna was shocked to see the departing coffin, but Nurse Angela assured her that none of the orphans had passed away in the night. Mrs. Grogan accompanied Dr. Larch to the cemetery. Larch had asked her to come with him because he knew that Mrs. Grogan enjoyed every opportunity to say her prayer. There was no minister or priest or rabbi in St. Cloud's. If holy words were in order, someone from Three Mile Falls came and said them. It was a testimony to Wilbur Larch's increasing isolationism that he refused to send to Three Mile Falls for anything, and that he preferred Mrs. Grogan, if he was forced to listen to holy words at all. It was the first burial that Wilbur Larch had wept over. Mrs. Grogan knew that his tears were not for Clara. Larch wouldn't have buried Clara if he'd thought that Homer Wells would ever be coming back. "Well, he's wrong," Nurse Angela said. "Even a saint can make a mistake.
Homer Wells will be back. He belongs here, like it or not.
Is it the ether? Dr. Larch wondered. He meant, was it the ether that gave him the sense increasingly that he knew everything that was going to happen? For example, he had anticipated the letter that arrived for F. Stone, forwarded from Fuzzy's P.O. box address.
"Is this some sick joke?" Nurse Angela asked, turning the envelope around and around.
"I'll take that, please," Dr. Larch said. It was from the Board of Trustees, as he had expected. That was why they'd wanted those follow-up reports from him and why they'd requested the addresses of the orphans. They were checking up on him, Larch knew.
The letter to Fuzzy began with cordial good wishes. It said that the board knew a great deal about Fuzzy from Dr. Larch, but they wished to know anything further about Fuzzy's St. Cloud's experience, anything, naturally, that he wanted to share with them.
The St. Cloud's experience sounded to Wilbur Larch like a mystical happening. The attached questionnaire made him furious, although he did amuse himself by trying to imagine which of the questions had been conceived by the tedious Dr. Gingrich, and which of them had flowed from the chilling mind of Mrs. Goodhall. Dr. Larch also had fun imagining how Homer Wells and Snowy Meadows and Curly Day, and all the others, would answer the silly questionnaire. But he took the immediate business very seriously. He wanted Fuzzy Stone's answers to the questionnaire to be perfect. He wanted to be sure that the Board of Trustees would never forget Fuzzy Stone. There were five questions. Every single one of them was based upon the incorrect assumption that every child must have been at least 5 or 6 years old before he or she was adopted. This and other stupidities convinced Wilbur Larch that Dr. Gingrich and Mrs. Goodhall were going to be easy adversaries. 1. Was your life at St. Cloud's properly supervised? Please include in your answer if you ever felt that your treatment was especially affectionate or especially instructive. We would certainly want to hear if you felt your treatment was ever abusive. 2. Did you receive adequate medical attention at St. Cloud's? 3. Were you adequately prepared for your new life in a foster home? And do you feel your foster home was carefully and correctly chosen? 4. Would you suggest any possible improvements in the methods and management of St. Cloud's? Specifically, would you feel things might have gone more smoothly for you if there had been a more youthful, energetic staff in residence, or perhaps simply a larger staff? 5. Was any attempt made to integrate the daily life of the orphanage with the life of the surrounding community?
"What community?" screamed Wilbur Larch.
He stood at the window in Nurse Angela's office and stared at the bleak hillside where Wally had wanted to plant apple trees. Why hadn't they come back and planted the stupid trees, even if all that business was just to please me, Larch wondered.
"What community?" he howled.
Oh, yes, he thought. I could have asked the station master to offer them religious instruction, to speak to them about the terrifying chaos of homeless souls hovering in every niche of the sky. I could have asked that worthy gentleman to display his underwear catalogs, too. I could have asked the family of child-beaters from Three Mile Falls to come once a week and give lessons. I could have detained a few of the women having abortions and asked them to reveal to all of us why they didn't want to have children at that particular moment in their lives. Or I could have invited a few of the mothers back. They could have explained to the children why they were left here. That would have been instructive. Oh, God, thought Wilbur Larch, what a community we could have been. If only I'd been more youthful, more energetic. Oh, yes, I've made some mistakes, he thought, and for a black hour or two he remembered some of them. If only I knew how to build a breathing machine, he thought. If only I could have come up with a different set of lungs for Fuzzy. And maybe Homer Wells will tell them that he was not adequately prepared for his first view of the fetus on the hill. And had there been a way to prepare Homer for Three Mile Falls, for the drapers of Waterville, or for the Winkles being swept away? What was my choice? Wondered Wilbur Larch. I suppose that I could have not apprenticed him. We are put on this earth to be of use, Wilbur Larch, as Fuzzy Stone, wrote to the Board of Trustees.
"It is better to do than to criticize," wrote that young idealist, Fuzzy Stone. "It is better to do anything than to stand idly by." "You tell 'em, Fuzzy," thought Dr. Larch. And so Fuzzy Stone told the Board of Trustees that the hospital at St. Cloud's was a model of the form. "It was Larch who made me want to be a doctor," Fuzzy wrote. "That old guy Larch, he's an inspiration. You talk about energy. The guy is as full of pep as a teenager." "You better be careful about sending any young people to St. Cloud's. Old Larch will work them so hard they'll get sick. They'll get so tired out they'll retire in a month." "And you think those old nurses don't do a day's work? Let me tell you, when Nurse Angela is pitching for stickball, you'd think you were competing in an Olympic event." "You talk about affectionate. That's them, all right. They're always hugging and kissing you, but they know how to shake some sense into you, too." "You talk about supervised," Fuzzy Stone wrote. "Did you ever find out that you were being watched by owls? That's Nurse Edna and Nurse Angela. They're owls. They don't miss a thing." And some of the girls used to say that Mrs. Grogan knew what they did before they did it, before they even knew they were going to do it. "And you talk about community," Fuzzy Stone wrote. "St. Cloud's was something special. Why, I remember people would get off the train and walk up the hill just to look the place over. It must have been because we were such a model community for that area. I just remember these people coming and going, coming and going. They were just there to look us over, as if we were one of the marvels of Maine." "One of the marvels of Maine," thought Wilbur Larch, struggling to get control of himself. A stray puff of wind blew in the open window in Nurse Angela's office, carrying some of the black smoke from the incinerator with it. The smoke brought Larch nearer to his senses. "I'd better stop," he thought. "I don't want to get carried away." He rested in the dispensary after his historical effort. Nurse Edna looked in on him once. Wilbur Larch was one of the marvels of Maine to her, and she was worried about him. Larch was a little worried himself when he woke. "Where'd the time gone? The problem is that I have to last," he thought. He could rewrite history, but he couldn't touch time. Dates were fixed. Time marched at its own pace. Even if he could convince Homer Wells to go to a real medical school, it would take time. It would take a few years for Fuzzy Stone to complete his training. "I have to last until Fuzzy is qualified to replace me," thought Wilbur Larch. He felt like hearing Mrs. Grogan's prayer again, and so he went to the girls' division a little early for his usual delivery of Jane Eyre. He eavesdropped in the hall on Mrs. Grogan's prayer. "I must ask her if she'd mind saying it to the boys," he thought, then wondered if it would confuse the boys, coming so quickly on the heels of, or just before, the Princes of Maine, Kings of New England benediction. "I get confused myself sometimes," Dr. Larch knew. "Grant us a safe lodging and a holy rest," Mrs. Grogan was saying, "and peace at the last." Amen, thought Wilbur Larch, the saint of St. Cloud's, who was 70-something and an ether addict, and who felt that he'd come a long way and still had a long way to go. When Homer Wells read the questionnaire sent him by the St. Cloud's Board of Trustees, he did not know exactly what made him anxious. Of course, Dr. Larch and the others were getting older, but they were always older, to him. It did occur to him to wonder what might happen to St. Cloud's when Dr. Larch was too old, but this thought was so troubling that he tucked the questionnaire and the return envelope to the board into his copy of Practical Anatomy of the Rabbit. Besides, it was the day the migrants arrived. It was harvest time at Ocean View, and Homer Wells was busy. He and Mrs. Worthington met the picking crew at the Apple Mart and led them to their quarters in the cider house. More than half the crew had picked at Ocean View before and knew the way, and the crew boss was what Mrs. Worthington called an old hand. He looked very young to Homer. It was the first year that Mrs. Worthington dealt directly with the picking crew and their boss. The hiring relationship by mail had been one of Senior Worthington's responsibilities, and Senior had always maintained that if you kept a good crew boss, year after year, all the hiring, and the necessary taking charge of the crew during the harvest, would be conducted by the boss. His name was Arthur Rose, and he looked about Wally's age, just barely older than Homer. Although he must have been older, he'd been the crew boss for 5 or 6 years.
One year, Senior Worthington had written to the old man who'd been his crew boss for as long as Olive could remember, and Arthur Rose had written back to Senior saying he was going to be the crew boss now. "The old boss," Arthur Rose had written, "he's dead tired of traveling." As it turned out, the old boss was just dead, but Arthur Rose had done a good job. He brought the right number of pickers, and very few of them ever quit, or ran off, or lost more than a day or two of good work because of too much drinking. There seemed to be a firm control over the degree of fighting among them, even when they were accompanied by a woman or two. And when there was an occasional child among them, the child behaved. There were always pickers who fell off ladders, but there'd been no serious injuries. There were always small accidents around the cider press, but that was fast, often late-night work, when the men were tired or drinking a little. And there was the predictable clumsiness or drinking that led to the infrequent accidents involved in the almost ritualistic use of the cider house roof. Running a farm had given Olive Worthington a warm feeling for the daylight hours and a grave suspicion of the night. The most trouble that people got into, in Olive's opinion, was trouble that they encountered because they stayed up too late. Olive had written Arthur Rose of Senior's death and told him that the picking crew responsibility of Ocean View had now fallen to her. She wrote him at the usual address, a P.O. box in a town called Green, South Carolina, and Arthur Rose responded promptly, both with his condolences and with his assurance that the crew would arrive as always, on time and in correct numbers. He was true to his word, except when writing his first name on an envelope, or when she annually noted it in his Christmas card, "Happy Holidays, Arthur." Olive Worthington never called him Arthur. No one else called him Arthur either. For reasons that were never explained to Homer Wells, but perhaps for a presence of authority that was necessary for a good crew boss to maintain, he was Mr. Rose to everybody. When Olive introduced him to Homer Wells, that measure of respect was made clear. "Homer," Olive said, "this is Mr. Rose, and this is Homer Wells," Olive added.
"Glad to know you, Homer," said Mr. Rose.
"Homer has become my good right hand," Olive said affectionately.
"Glad to hear that, Homer," said Mr. Rose.
He shook Homer's hand strongly, although he let go of the hand with unusual quickness. He was no better dressed than the rest of the picking crew, and he was slender like most of them. Yet he managed a certain style with shabbiness. If his jacket was dirty and torn, it was a pin-striped suit jacket, a double-breasted model that had, in its history, given someone a degree of sharpness, and Mr. Rose wore a real silk necktie for a belt. His shoes were also good, and good shoes were vital for farm work. They were old, but well-oiled, resoled, comfortable-looking, and in good condition. His socks matched. His suit jacket had a watch pocket, and in it was a gold watch that worked. He regarded the watch naturally and often as if time were very important to him. He was so clean-shaven, he looked as if he might never have needed a shave. His face was a smooth brick of the darkest, unsweetened, bitter chocolate, and in his mouth he expertly moved around a small, bright white mint, which always surrounded him with a fresh and alert fragrance. He spoke and moved slowly, modestly, yet deliberately. In both speech and gesture, he gave the impression of being humble and contained. Yet, when one observed him standing still and not speaking, he looked extraordinarily fast and sure of himself. It was a hot Indian summer day, and the Apple Mart was inland enough to miss what little sea breeze there was. Mr. Rose and Mrs. Worthington stood talking among the parked and moving farm vehicles in the Apple Mart lot. The rest of the picking crew waited in their cars. The windows rolled down, an orchestra of black fingers strumming the sides of the cars. There were 17 pickers and a cook. No women or children this year, to Olive's relief.
"Very nice," Mr. Rose said about the flowers in the cider house.
Mrs. Worthington touched the rules she'd tacked to the wall by the kitchen light switch as she was leaving. "And you'll point these out to everyone, won't you, please?" Olive asked.
"Oh, yes, I'm good at rules," said Mr. Rose, smiling.
"You all come back and watch the first press, Homer," Mr. Rose said, as Homer held open the van door for Olive. "I'm sure you got better things to watch, movies and stuff. But if you ever got some time on your hands, you come watch us make a little cider.
About 1,000 gallons, he added shyly. He scuffed his feet as if he were ashamed that he might be bragging. All we need is 8 hours and about 300 bushels of apples, said Mr. Rose. 1,000 gallons, he repeated proudly. On the way back to the apple mart, Olive Worthington said to Homer, Mr. Rose is a real worker. If the rest of them were like him, they could improve themselves. Homer didn't understand her tone. Certainly he had heard in her voice admiration, sympathy, and even affection, but there was also in her voice the ice that encases a long-ago and immovable point of view. Fortunately for Melanie, the picking crew at York Farm included 2 women and a child. Melanie felt safe to stay in the cider house. One of the women was a wife, and the other woman was the first woman's mother and the cook. The wife picked with the crew, while the old lady looked after the food and the child, who was silent to the point of non-existence. There was only 1 shower, and it was outdoors, installed behind the cider house on a cinder-block platform under a former grape arbor whose trellises were rotted by the weather. The women showered first every evening, and they permitted no peeking. The York Farm crew boss was a mild man. It was his wife who came along, and he raised no objections to Melanie sharing the cider house with his crew. His name was Rather. It was a nickname stemming from the man's laconic habit of remarking during each activity that he'd rather be doing something else. His authority seemed less certain, or at least less electrical than the authority commanded by Mr. Rose. No one called him Mr. Rather. He was a steady but not exceptionally fast picker, yet he always accounted for over 100 bushels a day. It took Melanie just 1 day to observe that his fellow workers paid Rather a commission. They gave him 1 bushel for every 20 bushels they picked. After all, Rather explained to Melanie, I get them the job. He was fond of saying that his commission, under the circumstances, was rather small, but Rather never suggested that Melanie owed him anything. After all, I didn't get you your job, he told her cheerfully. By her 3rd day in the field, she was managing 80 bushels. She also assisted as a bottler with the first cider press. Yet Melanie was disappointed. She'd found the time to ask if anyone had heard of Ocean View, and no one had. Perhaps because he viewed everything with slightly less cynicism than Melanie brought to each of her experiences, Homer Wells needed a few days to notice the commission Mr. Rose exacted from his crew. He was the fastest picker among them, without ever appearing to rush, and he never dropped fruit. He never bruised the apples by bumping his canvas picking bucket against the ladder rungs. Mr. Rose could have managed 110 bushels a day on his own, but even with his speed, Homer realized that his regular 150 or 160 bushels a day were very high. He took as his commission only 1 bushel out of every 40, but he had a crew of 15, and no one picked fewer than 80 bushels a day. Mr. Rose would pick a very fast half-dozen bushels, then he'd just rest for a while, or else he'd supervise the picking technique of his crew. A little slower, George, he'd say. You bruise that fruit, what's it going to be good for? Just cider, George would say. That's right, Mr. Rose would say. Cider apples is only a nickel a bushel. Okay, George would say. Sure, Mr. Rose would say. Everything's going to be okay. The 3rd day it rained and no one picked. Both apples and pickers slip in the rain, and the fruit is more sensitive to bruising. Homer went to watch Meanie Hyde and Mr. Rose conduct the first cider press, which they directed out of range of the splatter. They put 2 men on the press, and 2 bottling, and they shifted fresh men into the rotation almost every hour. Meanie watched only 1 thing, whether the racks were stacked crookedly or whether they were right. When the press boards are stacked crookedly, you can lose the press. 3 bushels of apples in 1 mess, 8 or 10 gallons of cider, and the pumice flying everywhere. The men at the press wore rubber aprons. The bottlers wore rubber boots. The whine of the grinder reminded Homer Wells of the sounds he had only imagined at St. Cloud's, the sawmill blades that were ear-splitting in his dreams and in his insomnia. The pump sucked, the spout disgorged a pulp of seeds and skin and mashed apples, and even worms, if there were worms. It looked like what Nurse Angela calmly called upchuck. From the big tub under the press,
The cider whirred through a rotary screen, which strained it into the 1,000-gallon vat where, only recently, Grace Lynch had exposed herself to Homer. In 8 hours of no-nonsense, they had 1,000 gallons. The conveyor tracks rattled the jugs along, straight into cold storage. A man named Branches was assigned to hose out the vat and rinse off the rotary screen. His name stemmed from his dexterity in the big trees, and his scorn for using a ladder. A man named Hero washed the press cloths. Meanie Hyde told Homer that the man had been a kind of hero once. "That's all I heard. He's been coming here for years, but he was a hero. Just once," Meanie added, as if there might be more shame attached to the rarity of the man's heroism than there was glory to be sung for his moment in the sun. "I'll bet you was bored," Mr. Rose said to Homer, who lied, who said it had been interesting. 8 hours of hanging around a cider mill are several hours in excess of interesting. "You got to come at night to get the real feel of it," Mr. Rose confided. "This was just a rainy day press. When you pick all day and press all night, then you get the feel of it." He winked at Homer, assuming he'd managed to make some secret life instantly clear. Then he handed Homer a cup of cider. Homer had been sipping cider all day, but the cup was offered solemnly. Some pledge about pressing cider at night was being made on the spot, and so Homer took the cup and drank. His eyes watered instantly. The cider was so strongly laced with rum that Homer felt his face flush and his stomach glow. Without further acknowledgment, Mr. Rose took back the cup and offered the remaining swallows to the man called Branches, who bolted it down without needing to make the slightest adjustment on the spray nozzle of his hose. When Homer Wells was loading some cider jugs into the van, he saw the cup make its way between Meanie Hyde and the man called Hero, all of it under the calm supervision of Mr. Rose, who had not revealed the source of the rum to anyone. The phrase, "a gift for concealment," occurred to Homer Wells in regard to Mr. Rose. Homer had no idea where such a phrase had come from, unless it was Charles Dickens or Charlotte Bronte. He doubted he had encountered it in Gray's Anatomy, or in Bensley's Practical Anatomy of the Rabbit. There were no movements wasted in what movement there was to be seen by Mr. Rose, a quality that Homer Wells had formerly associated only with Dr. Larch. Surely Dr. Larch had other, quite different qualities, as did Mr. Rose. Back at the Apple Mart, the harvest appeared at a momentary standstill, held up by the rain, which Big Dot Taft and the Mart women watched sourly from their assembly line positions along the conveyor tracks in the packing line. No one seemed very excited by the cider Homer brought. It was very bland, as the first cider usually is, and too watery, composed typically of early Max and Gravensteins. "You don't get a good cider until October," Meanie Hyde had told Homer, and Mr. Rose had confirmed this with a solemn nod. A good cider needs some of those last-picked apples, golden delicious and winter banana, and the bald ones are russets, too. "Cider's got no smoke before October," said Big Dot Taft, inhaling her cigarette listlessly. Homer Wells, listening to Big Dot Taft, felt like her voice, dulled. Wally was away, Candy was away, and the anatomy of a rabbit was, after Clara, no challenge. The migrants, whom he'd so eagerly anticipated, were just plain hard workers. Life was just a job. He had grown up without noticing when. Was there nothing remarkable in the transition? They had 4 days of good picking weather at Ocean View before Meanie Hyde said there would be a night press, and Mr. Rose again invited Homer to come to the cider house and get the feel of it. Homer had a quiet dinner with Mrs. Worthington, and only after he'd helped her wash the dishes did he say he thought he'd go to the cider house and see if he could help with the pressing. He knew they would have been hard at work for 2 or 3 hours. "What a good worker you are, Homer," Olive told him appreciatively. Homer Wells shrugged. It was a cold, clear night, the very best weather for Macintosh apples, warm, sunny days and cold nights. It was not so cold that Homer couldn't smell the apples as he walked to the cider house, and it was not so dark that he needed to keep on the dirt road. He could go overland. Because he was not on the road, he was able to approach the cider house unobserved. For a while he stood outside the range of the lights blazing in the mill room and listened to the sounds of the men working the press. and talking and laughing, and the murmur of the men who were talking and laughing on the cider house roof. Homer Wells listened for a long time, but he realized that when the men were not making an effort to be understood by a white person, he couldn't understand them at all, not even Mr. Rose, whose clear voice appeared to punctuate the other voices with calm but emphatic interjections. They were also pressing cider at York Farm that night, but Melanie wasn't interested. She wasn't trying to understand either the process or the lingo. The crew boss, rather, had made it clear to her that the men resented her working the press or even bottling. It cut into their extra pay. Melanie was tired from the picking, anyway. She lay on her bed in the bunk room of the cider house, reading Jane Eyre. There was a man asleep at the far end of the bunk room, but Melanie's reading light didn't disturb him. He had drunk too much beer, which was all that rather allowed the men to drink. The beer was kept in the cold storage room right next to the mill, and the men were drinking and talking together while they ran the press. The friendly woman named Sandra, who was Rather's wife, was sitting on a bed not far from Melanie, trying to mend a zipper on a pair of one of the men's trousers. The man's name was Sammy, and he had only one pair of trousers. Every so often he'd wander in from the mill room to see how Sandra's work was progressing. An overlarge, ballooning pair of undershorts hanging almost to his knobby knees, his legs below the knees like tough little vines. Sandra's mother, whom everyone called Ma, and who cooked plain but large meals for the crew, lay in a big lump on the bed next to Sandra, more than her share of blankets piled on top of her. She was always cold, but it was the only thing she complained about. Sammy came into the bunk room sipping a beer and bringing with him the apple mash odor of the mill room. The splatter from the press dotted his bare legs. "Legs like that, no wonder you want your pants back," Sandra said. "What are my chances?" Sammy asked. "One, your zipper is jammed. Two, you tore it off your pants," Sandra said. "What are you in such a hurry with your zipper for?" Ma asked, without moving from her lumped position. "Shit," Sammy said. He went back to the press. Every once in a while the grinder caught on something, a thick stem or a congestion of seeds, and it made a noise like a circular saw gagging on a knot. When that happened, Ma would say, "There goes somebody's hand," or, "There goes somebody's whole head, drunk too much beer and fell in." Over it all, Melanie managed to read. She wasn't being antisocial, in her view. The two women were nice to her once they realized she was not after any of the men. The men were respectful of her work, and of the mark upon her that was made by the missing boyfriend. Although they teased her, they meant her no harm. She had lied successfully to one of the men, and the lie, as she knew it would, had gotten around. The man was named Wednesday, for no reason that was ever explained to Melanie, and she wasn't interested enough to ask. Wednesday had asked her too many questions about the particular ocean view she was looking for, and the boyfriend she was trying to find. She had snagged her ladder in a loaded tree and was trying to ease it free without shaking any apples to the ground. Wednesday was helping her when Melanie said, "Pretty tight pants I'm wearing, wouldn't you say?" Wednesday looked at her and said, "Yeah, I would." "You can see everything in the pockets, right?" Melanie asked. Wednesday looked again and saw only the odd sickle shape of the partially opened horn-rimmed beret. Tight and hard against the worn denim, it dug into Melanie's thigh. It was the beret that Mary Agnes Cork had stolen from Candy, and Melanie had stolen for herself. One day, she imagined, her hair might be long enough for the beret to be of use. Until such a time, she carried it like a pocket knife in her right thigh pocket. "What's that?" Wednesday asked. "That's a penis knife," Melanie said.
"A what knife?" Wednesday said.
"You heard me," Melanie said. "It's real small and it's real sharp. It's good for just one thing."
"What's that?" Wednesday asked.
"It cuts off the end of a penis," Melanie said.
"Real fast, real easy, just the end."
If the picking crew at York Farm had been a knife-carrying crew, someone might have asked Melanie to display the penis knife, just as an object of general appreciation among knife-carrying friends. But no one asked. The story appeared to hold. It allied itself with the other stories attached to Melanie and solidified the underlying uneasy feeling among the workers at York Farm, that Melanie was no one to mess around with. Around Melanie, even the beer drinkers behaved. The only ill effect of the York Farm picking crew drinking beer while they pressed cider was the frequency of their urinating, which Melanie objected to only when they peed too near the cider house. "Hey, I don't want to hear that," she'd holler out the window when she could hear anyone pissing. "I don't want to smell it later either. Get away from the building. What's the matter, you afraid of the dark?" Sandra and Ma liked Melanie for that, and they enjoyed the refrain. Whenever they heard someone peeing, they would not fail to holler in unison, "What's the matter, you afraid of the dark?" But if everyone tolerated Melanie's hardness, or even appreciated her for it, no one liked her reading at night. She was the only one who read anything, and it took a while for her to realize how unfriendly they thought reading was, how insulted they felt when she did it. When they finished pressing that night and everyone settled into bed, Melanie asked, as usual, if her reading light was going to bother anyone.
"The light don't bother nobody," Wednesday said.
There were murmurs of consent, and Rather said,
"You all remember Cameron?"
There was laughter, and Rather explained to Melanie that Cameron, who had worked at York Farm for years, had been such a baby that he needed a light on all night just to sleep.
"He thought animals were going to eat him if he shut out the light," Sammy said.
"What animals?" Melanie asked.
"Cameron didn't know," somebody said.
Melanie kept reading Jane Eyre, and after a while, Sandra said, "It's not the light that bothers us, Melanie."
"Yeah," someone said.
Melanie didn't get it for a while, but gradually she became aware that they had all rolled toward her in their beds and were watching her sullenly.
"Okay," she said, "so what bothers you?"
"What you reading about, anyway?" Wednesday asked.
"Yeah," Sammy said. "What's so special about that book?"
"It's just a book," Melanie said.
"Pretty big deal that you can read it, huh?"
Wednesday asked.
"What?"
said Melanie.
"Maybe if you like it so much," Rather said, "we might like it, too."
"You want me to read to you?" Melanie asked.
"Somebody read to me once," Sandra said. "It wasn't me," Ma said. "It wasn't your father, either."
"I never said it was," Sandra said.
"I never heard nobody read to nobody," Sammy said.
"Yeah," somebody said.
Melanie saw that some of the men were propped on their elbows in their beds, waiting. Even Ma turned her great lump around and faced Melanie's bed.
"Quiet, everybody," Rather said.
For the first time in her life, Melanie was afraid. After all her efforts and her hard traveling, she felt she had been returned to the girls' division without being aware of it. But it wasn't only that. It was the first time anyone had expected something of her. She knew what Jane Eyre meant to her, but what could it mean to them? She'd read it to children too young to understand half the words, too young to pay attention until the end of a sentence. But they were orphans, prisoners of the routine of being read to aloud. It was the routine that mattered. Melanie was more than halfway in her third or fourth journey through Jane Eyre. She said,
"I'm on page 208. There's a lot that's happened before."
"Just read it," Sammy said.
"Maybe I should start at the beginning," Melanie suggested.
"Just read what you read to yourself," Rather said gently.
Her voice had never trembled before, but Melanie began. "The wind roared high in the great tree which embowered the gates."
"What's embowered?" Wednesday asked her.
"Like a bower," Melanie said. "Like a thing hanging over you, like for grapes or roses."
"It's a kind of bower where the shower is," Sandra said.
"Oh," someone said.
"But the road, as far as I could see," Melanie continued, "to the right hand and left, was all still and solitary."
"What's that?" Sammy asked.
"Solitary is alone," Melanie said.
"Like solitaire, you know, solitaire," Rather said, and there was an approving murmur.
"Shut up, you're interrupting," Sandra said.
"Well, we got to understand," Wednesday said.
"Just shut up," Ma said.
"Read," Rather said to Melanie, and she tried to go on. "The road, all still and solitary, save for the shadows of clouds crossing it at intervals, as the moon looked out, it was but a long pale line, unvaried by one moving speck," Melanie read.
"On what?" someone asked. "Unvaried means unchanged, not changed," Melanie said.
"I know that," Wednesday said. "I got that one."
"Shut up," Sandra said.
"A puerile tear," Melanie began, but she stopped.
"I don't know what puerile means," she said. "It's not important that you know what every word means."
"Okay," someone said.
A puerile tear dimmed my eye while I looked. A tear of disappointment and impatience. Ashamed of it, I wiped it away.
"There, we know what it is anyway," Wednesday said.
"I lingered," Melanie read.
"You what?"
Sammy asked.
"Hung around. To linger means to hang around," Melanie said sharply.
She began again.
The moon shut herself wholly within her chamber and drew close her curtain of dense cloud. The night grew dark.
"It's getting scary now," Wednesday observed.
The rain came driving fast on the wind. Melanie had changed gale to wind without their knowing it. "I wish he would come. I wish he would come," I exclaimed, seized with hypochondriac foreboding.
Melanie stopped with that. Tears filled her eyes, and she couldn't see the words. There was a long silence before anyone spoke.
"What was she seized with?"
Sammy asked, frightened.
"I don't know," Melanie said, sobbing. "Some kind of fear, I think."
They were respectful of Melanie's sobs for a while, and then Sammy said,
"I guess it's some kind of horror story."
"What you want to read that before you try to sleep?"
Rather asked Melanie with friendly concern, but Melanie lay down on her bed and turned off her reading light. When all the lights were out, Melanie felt Sandra sit on her bed beside her. If it had been Ma, she knew, her bed would have sagged more heavily.
"You ask me, you better forget that boyfriend," Sandra said. "If he didn't tell you how to find him, he ain't no good anyway."
Melanie had not felt anyone stroke her temples since Mrs. Grogan in the girls' division at St. Cloud's. She realized she missed Mrs. Grogan very much, and for a while this took her mind off Homer Wells. When everyone else was asleep, Melanie turned her reading light back on. Whatever failure Jane Eyre might be for someone else, it had always worked for Melanie, it had helped her, and she felt in need of its help now. She read another 20 pages or so, but Homer Wells would not leave her mind.
"I must part with you for my whole life," she read with horror. "I must begin a new existence amongst strange faces and strange scenes."
The truth of that closed the book for her forever. She slid the book under her bed in the bunk room in the cider house at York Farm, where she would leave it. Had she just read the passage from David Copperfield that Homer Wells so loved and repeated to himself as if it were a hopeful prayer, she would have discarded David Copperfield, too. "I have stood aside to see the phantoms of those days go by me." Fat chance, Melanie would have thought. She knew that all the phantoms of those days were attached to her and Homer more securely than their shadows. And so Melanie cried herself to sleep. She was not hopeful, yet she was determined, her mind's eye searching the darkness for Homer Wells. She could not have seen him that night. He was so well hidden beyond the range of the lights shining from the mill room at Ocean View. Even if he'd sneezed or fallen down, the sound of the grinder and the pump would have concealed his presence. He watched the red-eyed glow of the cigarettes that darted and paused above the roof of the cider house. When he got cold, he went to watch them pressing and to have a little cider and rum. Mr. Rose seemed glad to see him. He gave Homer a drink with very little cider in it, and together they watched the orchestra of the pump and grinder. A man named Jack, who had a terrible scar across his throat, a hard-to-survive kind of scar, aimed the spout. A man named Orange slapped the racks in place and received the splatter with a wild kind of pride. His name was Orange because he had tried to dye his hair once, and orange was how it had turned out. There was no evidence of that color on him now. The rum had made Jack and Orange both savage about their business and defiantly unwary of the flying mess. Yet Homer felt that Mr. Rose, who seemed sober, was still in control. The conductor of both the men and the machinery and operating them both at full throttle. "Let's try to get out of here by midnight," Mr. Rose said calmly. Jack choked the flow of pumice to the top rack. Orange levered